Welcome to the MVC Storefront, Part 25. This is a real-world application building exercise wherein we build out an e-commerce storefront using ASP.NET MVC, as well as other cool technologies like test-driven development and so forth. My name is Rob Connery. I work for Microsoft. My email is robcon@microsoft.com. Please email me if you have any questions or feel free to leave a comment on this blog. This episode is going to be a little bit different today. I'm a little bit stuck. Not technically, per se, just really not very happy with where I am currently with the application. I've been thinking back a lot about what I've been doing, where I've been, and how I've been doing things. And I'm okay with the way things have turned out. But as I reflect more and more, I keep thinking that there's something just not clicking. Something just plain doesn't seem right. As I'm going through the application and kind of looking at the code and the way things are structured, it just didn't really kind of fill me with any sort of, just the kind of thing that it should fill you with. When I tried to explain it to people, the explanations just weren't clicking. And, they'd ask me certain questions like, well, why did you do it this way? And why did you name a certain thing this way? And, I kind of get into kind of the inconsistencies and the complexity and how I was carrying things out. I mean, overall, demos just were not inspiring. And that's kind of a problem when you're trying to show people this thing that you've built, that you've taken this much time, you got community feedback, and I couldn't necessarily justify the choices I'd made. Overall, I would describe the feeling as sort of meh. That's what I've told people. Didn't really do much. So the reason I thought of that was that the complexity, I think, just sort of got away from me. E-commerce sites are really easy to kind of grow and spiral into complexity. I kind of figured I might hit this point, and I sort of left it for refactoring. I kind of knew I would later. I wasn't sure how much, though. And so I got to a certain point last week. I think I mentioned this on my blog. I've mentioned it publicly, where I said, it's time to rethink what I'm doing. I don't have to do a wholesale fire drill here. I just kind of need to look at the site, think of what I'm doing, and essentially make it cooler, kind of make it work a little bit better. So when people look at it, it's actually inspiring, or it's something they could ask questions about that's based on fundamentals. And so what I thought I would do is, since a lot of people have talked to me about DDD in the past, domain-driven design, I thought I would give it a swing here, because I know that domain-driven design is sort of a methodology that was built out of tackling complexity. And, I don't think that an e-commerce site by itself is terribly complex. It is a very, very standard application. However, it is a ubiquitous application, and just about every application you can build on the internet is usually based on the concept of selling something. And I think that what I need to do here is I need to kind of gear my application to not be so bland and to be a little bit more directed. And that's what I want to do. That is my effort today. So in this episode, what you're going to see is my first efforts at kind of restructuring the application. You'll also see and hear me talk to people like Dave Larrabee, Ayende Rahin, and also Scott Belwar. And I have a lot of footage and a lot of coverage here, so I'm probably going to split this whole episode out probably into three parts. Talking today to Mr. Dave Larrabee of, I guess you could say, of CodeBetter.com. What would you say? Dave Larrabee of what?
Dave Larrabee of Atlanta.
Dave, I like it. Today we're talking about domain-driven design, otherwise known as DDD. And as some may know who've been following the Storefront series, my latest efforts are to kind of remove some of the wackiness, let's call it code smell, from the Storefront application. One of the things I thought might help would be domain-driven design. I've been studying up on it and trying to get to know it better. I need some help, and so I called Dave, and Dave graciously decided to help me. Dave, if for those of you who might not know, Dave is the guy that came up with the term alt.net, which is an interesting thing, a little bit interesting trivia. So let's just start at a really high level, because most of the people that watch this may or may not be familiar with DDD. They may be like me. Maybe they've heard of it and possibly even read a book or two. Can you explain kind of in generic terms, I don't want to say elevator pitch because that's not really applicable, but maybe in high-level terms, what the heck is DDD?
Well, DDD is a collection of techniques, patterns, practices, design guidelines aimed at you kind of finding where the value of your application is and then putting that value into a model that is code.
Interesting. So, you know, the interesting thing, something I found about the developer community is that I don't want to say they don't want to learn new things because that sounds too kind of old man-ish of me. There's a resistance. There's a resistance to learning, especially a sweeping approach like DDD. People basically want you to prove it to them. And what's the value here? And what I have found is very difficult when people tell me about DDD is the terms are so generic. And then the Jeremy Miller, I love this. He called this a jargon explosion. I said on my blog the other day that it was just basically a collection of patterns, and I got kind of hammered for it. I mean, I know it's not. It's more than that. I mean, by patterns, I mean things like repository pattern, you know, unit of work, etc. But there's a lot more to it. There's a lot with project approach and so on. Can you elaborate
on
that?
Stop right there. Let's just unpack that a little bit.
Sure.
Whoever hammered you for saying it's a collection of patterns, I would take issue with, because it is a collection of patterns.
Well, I mean, Nilsson said that much in his book. That's why I kind of repeated that. But, you know, I understand, too, that it's a little bit more. It's also a mindset in terms of the overall project approach.
Just, I mean, keep in mind, you know, patterns can be software patterns. They can be patterns of communication. They can be patterns of teamwork. I mean, to a certain extent, a iteration or a sprint is a pattern for, you know, in agility for, so we can call anything really a pattern, not to get too meta, right?
Right,
but
sure.
I think that's a better way of thinking about domain-driven design, and someone actually pointed this out to me recently, that it's a better way of thinking of it as a collection of patterns than a methodology.
It's
not a methodology. It is more a technique or a bundle of techniques that we can then apply to our designs. It does help us with our design approach, our design philosophy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not super important to really peg that definition. I mean,
right.
I think that's, but, you know, this just illustrates how religious, you know, the talk about domain-driven design is. And one thing we need to do is, as we're learning something, we need to put that in the back burner.
Yes.
We need to think about what's the biggest bang for a buck we can get, and the first thing to do is what you did, is cultivate an interest, go out, buy the book, and read it. Read the domain-driven design book. Just suck it up and read it. The ubiquitous language, and a lot of people don't like that term. I was talking to Dan North, who's the guy that kind of invented behavior-driven development, and he prefers the term shared language, which I think brings it about half the way it needs to come, because ubiquitous is kind of like, you know, vocab, you know, flossing the vocab a little bit. Like, I feel like shared language gets a little closer to what it is just, yeah, we're speaking the same language. When someone says account, I know what that means. When someone says shopping cart, I know what that means. And it's more than that. It's taking that thing and also seeing a corresponding class in your code that is named that thing. So ubiquitous language goes end to end. It goes all the way down into the code, and we see these terms mirrored in the code that we use, you know, from our voice processors, you know.
And I know at this point there's someone listening to this right now that says, oh, that's crap. I've been doing that for years. And that's fair. That's a fair thing to say, because that was my first reaction to it. You know, I worked with Ameritech, which is one of the baby bells, and I had to go in there and I had to write a call center information retrieval application. And I had to sit with these call center reps. In fact, I had to sit in the call center next to the operator as they answered the phone. The amount of information I gleaned was awesome. And I sat next to them and we talked back and forth. But I don't think it was as rigorous as perhaps the ubiquitous language process is about. And maybe take me down, if I was back at Ameritech sitting next to, let's call them the domain experts, the call center reps, what would be a process that we would define our ubiquitous language together that would help me write a better bit of software?
Well, I mean, I think just using the terms that they use, or asking, hey, you've used this term a little bit, why don't you define it for me? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you're sitting down with some context of building a retrieval app. Mm-hmm. So you have the first few marching orders, you know, the first kind of initial features that you're trying to put into the application, mm-hmm. even if it's at a very large level, and you're there to kind of figure out the details. Well, as you figure out the details, I mean, watch yourself when you're talking to a domain expert, or you're talking to someone, an end user. Watch yourself, you know, prevent yourself from mutating or abstracting what they say into maybe, quote-unquote, something that you think is better. Chances are that's baloney. So you're going to create this friction between what's in your software and what's being said. Right. So I think the notion of the pattern ubiquitous language, I don't think you can really call BS on it, because yes, a lot of people are using it. That just means it's a pattern.
Right.
This is
well,
the
I
first
don't
time we saw it written down. You know?
Right. Okay. Well, that's fair, yeah. Because you know this. Is, okay, so I think you're hitting on a major point. So when I sat with those call center reps, they of course had jargon of the yin yang. They broke down the call into segments. And they had hostility levels applied to it. That went not just hostile, but from good to bad, whatever. But they had first contact. They had the notion of resolution. They had all these ways that they segmented the calls and the way they thought about the calls, and you know what kind of call was it? In fact, the notion of a call itself was itself a very very defined process. Now, for me as a developer, I might be tempted to take that call and say, well, it's actually a contact. It's not really a call. But no, see, this is the thing. I think what you're saying is, with domain-driven design, that is a call, and you better call it a call, because ubiquitous language says to call it a call. Is that right?
It is. I mean, you got to think, you have to put all of this in some kind of context, and you have to say, is this application I'm developing some kind of really important app, which it probably sounds like it, you know, in this case, is it really specific? Why are they building this rather than buying this? And if
right.
there's some competitive advantage to be had, well, yes, model the business process, model the business vocabulary. A bounded context is simply...
I just happen to have the tab up right here.
I know, isn't... You are good. You're really good.
I read your mind.
So a bounded context is, again, one of those amorphous terms, and we you kind of mentioned... but it really is a boundary. It's a scope to which we are applying this language. So in the case of your baby bell that you're working for, a call in the support area or support department is something wholly different than a call in the customer self-service application.
Or like the sales call, for instance. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. So this call means something different. Now, my preference is to try to... If it's like a sales call, usually they call it a sales call. They may shorten it to call, but there's no problem just referring to it as a sales call. Those boundaries are the different areas of your application. So sometimes we get into these applications that just model everything, and we end up with hundreds of entities and hundreds of, you know, thousands of classes, and it's just a monolith. It's this big old honking piece of software. Well, what bounded context encourages us to do is think about the areas of cohesiveness, areas where these classes belong together, and oftentimes
where they make sense. If I could, add that in, where they
absolutely
make sense. Okay,
I mean, I think of in your MVC storefront, you know, in the MVC commerce app, fulfillment is a separate bounded context. Then is supply chain, you know, and reordering perhaps.
True.
Then is the front end, which is I think primarily what your application is dealing with is the taking orders and, you know, shopping cart and catalog and stuff. Catalog might be in its own context.
Okay.
Product design might be in its own context, depending on what we're selling.
Well, you know, let's do this. Let's. I know you only have another 20 minutes or so. How about we take this from maybe a project approach, which I think is an awesome background because you got to have it. You got to know this is where we're coming from, or whatever. and jump now into the more technical realm. All right. Well, the first, this is in no order, but most of the people that have been following know that I've been using a version of the repository pattern. And if you ever want to know any more about it, and I'm just going to touch on this in summary form, head over to martinfowler.com and or even just Google it, repository, and you can kind of see a little bit more of what it is. And this is just sort of, it's supposed to, it's a layer, it's not a layer, it's a, I guess what you call a layer or a.
I would call a repository an anti-corruption layer that represents an in-memory collection of our entities.
Okay.
Let me unwind that because there's a lot of jargon in there.
Jargon explosion,
So
kaboom!
we're gonna pop the stack here. The basic thing is a repository is a place I go to fetch my entities and save them when I'm done with them or when I have a new entity. Now, I
Okay.
think in the case of and it's really funny that we start talking about domain-driven design and repository because really, I mentioned it's an anti-corruption layer. We want to keep our domain model as infrastructure-free as possible because we want to focus what's going on there on the concern of modeling that domain. So a repository is just how we get the entity. So oftentimes you'll see like real purists leave their repository implementations out and simply have an interface. Now this is kind of what an anti-corruption layer, and this is in the covered in the Eric Evans book, gives you, is it gives you a little area where you're going to allow a little bit of a leaky abstraction into your model on your terms, just what your model really needs to utilize, and put the implementation either in a separate class if you want to get kind of be lo-fi about it, or put it in a separate assembly if you want to be kind of, pure and anal about it.
So by anti-corruption, what is it? I mean, give me a hint about that. What does that mean?
You can almost think of a anti-corruption layer as like well, you could think of it as like a condom for your domain model, I guess.
So quite all right.
Right, so you may, I don't know if you're pursuing some kind of.
We're into safe coding here.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So you've got your domain model, but you need to bring something in from the outside. So in the case of where you've got your model that's bounded and focused on the issue of, a storefront and shopping cart and all that kind of online e-commerce stuff, you also need to talk to fulfillment at some point because when an order happens, you need to fulfill that thing. Well, we may see an iFulfillment service inside of our model that just has what we need to send an order down the fulfillment pipeline or down the fulfillment chain or initiate a fulfillment process. And it's valuable to see it from there because it does, the two are connected. But the implementation actually lives in the fulfillment. We do some mapping and we translate the order from the front end to a fulfillment order on the back end.
Okay, that makes sense. And you're crossing, at that point, you're crossing a boundary layer,
Exactly.
right? Okay,
And
okay.
we don't need to sweat it. I mean, we don't need to be super
Yeah.
we don't need to be crazy code Nazis about it. We can go in there
All right.
and we can make it pretty lo-fi. We just want to reveal that intent from where we
Yeah.
need it. I really like to think of unit of work as kind of a journal. It's a
Okay.
little mini, if people are familiar with like a transaction journal or something, it's a mini record of everything that happens. Now, some people, like if your watchers are are familiar with Greg Young, who's on Code Better with me, he just stores that all those little things and then replays them when he needs to rehydrate something. That's a very extreme way to do it, but it's also a very smart way to do it if you have a scalability issue. But in a lot of cases, it's just recording these little things that happen. This entity changed, this entity was dirty, this entity was deleted. And then at some point, you're going to commit that whole series of changes, which might affect a number of entities down to
Right.
down to a database or a file or, write ahead log or whatever it is that you're, saving.
And the good
So,
news for the folks out there who might be sweating, saying, "What the hell are you talking about?" The good news is that if you're 99% sure you're covered based on your data access technologies, if you're using Link to SQL, that's what the data context is. It is a unit of work. It follows the unit of work pattern, I should say. With EF, I believe there's a context there as well that does the same thing. In addition, nHibernate, if you use nHibernate, the session follows unit of work. So Subsonic, unfortunately, does not. But we're working on that. Anyway, the point is, That's you're probably covered if you're using that data access technology. And I'm going to touch on that in a little bit with some code with you today to show you how I'm implementing in a little bit of a spike that I've been doing.
Factory, a domain-driven design factory, is often represents like an abstract factory or a prototypical factory or a factory method from, you know, the more traditional canon of software development, just to totally blow up the terminology scene there for a bit. But I would say they're a bit different. I mean, what factory is really about is if you've got a lot of invariance in your classes, and by that I mean the class really, you know, an invariant is kind of a truth statement we can make about the class. Like, if this is true, I know I can invoke this method or that kind of thing. Definitely look it up in Wikipedia. It's a computer science term that's important. But if we have a lot of invariance in a particular aggregate root or entity, what we want to do is be able to have an area. And if you recall from the Gang of Four, a factory is a creational pattern. So we want to have an area where whatever I get back is going to have its invariance satisfied. But in the meantime, while it's being created, I've got to do all this junk. I've got to go out, like you said, with an order, go out, you know, maybe an order is a bad example, but say like with an insurance policy. I create an insurance policy, while I also need to create a corresponding audit that makes sure that the next, when that year's up, I verify that, you know, the insured amount was correct. Things like that. And these are just side effects that happen. We can kind of encapsulate that in a factory. So, yeah, I mean, that's there tend to be one of the more useful but less frequent patterns that, you know, you see. Yeah.
Well, it's good. You know, one of the things that hit me as I was looking at this is, you know, I got a lot of constructor overloads, and I thought, wow, this is a great way to reduce the complexity, which is what DDD is all about, or address the complexity, let's put that.
Law of Demeter is basically the why, the ultimate why of Law of Demeter is making sure that you don't overcouple your system. I like to think of it really simply, and there are four rules. I can remember a few of them. You can refer to the type itself. You can refer to an argument, a member on an argument, and then there's one other. But basically, I like to think of this as the deep dotting rule. So if you see a lot of deep dotting, every time you see a dot, you have a point of coupling. So if we kind of strive for one dot, now there and there are definitely areas where this law of Demeter doesn't really apply. That would be when, you know, you have a fluent interface, a method chain, something like that, where it's something that just keeps returning this in all of its methods. But where it does apply, you know, you want to kind of pay attention to it because there's this whole kind of notion of coupling. And a highly coupled system will be a system that is harder to change, that is harder to maintain. So when you have coupling from object A to six objects, it's a little more like rigid than if you have coupling to two objects, to two dependencies.
I'm going to transition really quickly over to the storefront and tell you why I'm having a bit of a gag reflex. And I can't explain it. I mean, you hear the term code smell all the time. I don't really equate it with a smell. I equate it more with just an uneasy, queasy feeling. And I'll tell you where this all came from is that I was showing this to some folks internal at Microsoft, my new boss, showing it to him, walking him through it. And, you know, he generally liked it. I don't think anything is necessarily bad about it. But there's a lot of points that are just overly complex. And you and I talked about this before we got started here today. And I showed you how I have this service layer that's supposed to encapsulate the business logic. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of times what I've run into, and let's just take a look at catalog service, what I run into are these things like, get product. You know, I just kind of say, okay, repository, go get me a product. And it doesn't really serve a purpose. It has no reason to live. And so it almost blurs the responsibility of the classes. I mean, who's responsible for getting this out of the database? So
the main, for me, the main responsibility of services is to, there's a couple. One is to aggregate cohesive operations. So you may end up with it.
By couple, you mean two, right?
What do you mean by couple? I mean, no. Yeah.
Because there's you said there's reasons and there's a couple, and I'm like, okay, is he mean
Yes.
that one?
No. There are several. Let's just put it in
Okay.
that. Two that I can think of immediately.
All right.
One is to kind of aggregate the cohesive operations, and that's a really nerdy way of saying that we've got an account service where we're going to open accounts, make deposits, things like that. So we're almost providing a little API to our UI. Now, along those veins, what I see right here, which is a smell, and by smell I mean an indication that I want to actually give some design weight to what you're doing here. Not necessarily a bad thing, but product is probably an entity that's in your model somewhere.
It sure is, yeah.
So rather than that, what I like to do is create a boundary at the service layer that says, at the application service layer, because we could go into the whole riff about domain services versus application services, but a boundary at the service layer that says, "Hey UI, I'm the API and I'm going to give you just what you need because I'm a nice guy. I'm going to give you a nice flat representation of orders with customer name in them and you can bind it and great." But from the model side, I'm going to translate the model stuff into what the UI needs. So you end up with mapping code, or you end up getting a message or a DTO from the UI that says, "Do this thing," and then translating that into model terms, like acting on a repository, things like that.
So when in terms of MVC, one of the things that Scott Gu likes a lot is the concept of the view model, where you have this very strictly defined class. Let's say we're talking about a page that has a catalog list on the left side, a list of products according to I mean, I'm sorry, a category list on the left side, a list of products that correspond to, say, a selected category, and then maybe on the right side some ads. And so what he would like to see in that sense is an overall view model, a representation of all the data hung on a strictly or a statically defined type. Is that what you're talking about here?
Yeah, and I think to some extent you really want to watch trying to reuse those things. They're really not. I mean, public. If you don't care about mutability or being, about if you're in your tr own trust boundary, you don't care about things changing. You could just use public fields,
Okay.
And I wouldn't necessarily sweat the reuse. Like sometimes though, for a view model, I might come up with like an add view model and a view model for the orders and a view model for whatever, and then stitch that together, compose that into something that's a little bit closer to my UI.
I
Again,
see.
be pragmatic about it. See, understand when you're pursuing diminishing returns. It might
Right.
not be worth it.
Well, all right. Well, let's do this. I wish I had more time to dive into this code with you, but I think what we can do is, I will take this on in later in this episode, where I'll dive into this a little bit more detail, show some other things that bugged me. For right now, this is the primary thing. In addition, I call this a code explosion. A lot of code to do what is really a simple thing, which is to show products. Up until this point, there's been a lot of talk and not too much code, and I want to thank you for your patience. And I'm going to jump into the code in just a second. I do want to say a quick follow-up that I had a phone call with Scott Bellware yesterday, and he had been listening to the Hansel Minutes interview I did with respect to DDD just the other day. If you hadn't listened to it, head over to hanselminutes.com. You can hear me blather on about DDD and what I'm learning. Anyway, in that interview, Scott Hanselman and I had talked about the lack of demo material. Actually, I talked about it, the lack of demo stuff that's out there, the lack of samples. And so what Scott Bellware called to point out, and I thought that was a really good point to bring up, is that there's no demos or samples necessarily because DDD is heavily business focused, and it's really hard just to sort of make things up. And so we talked about the fact that I'm a little bit at a disadvantage here because I don't really have a client. And it's something that I pointed out on Hanselman's interview as well. So to that end, what I want to do is I want to say it again that I'm starting to refocus now and sort of pretend or listen to voices in my head from my client that I worked with over the last 7 years up until I got the job at Microsoft. And I built out a number of e-commerce sites for them. I know their business process really well, so I have a good dialogue going here. It's not going to approximate the real thing, but I hope it gets close. And anyway, I'm going to try and leverage my experience that way. The way I'm doing that, if you're wondering, what does that mean, Rob? It means like if I'm answering or asking questions, like how would I do this thing, which you normally rely on the concept of ubiquitous language to answer, in other words, client dialogue, I literally have my client's voice in my head, walk through their process, try and figure out how they would handle something. So to that end, let's jump into the code, and I'll show you specifically what I'm talking about. Again, this is just me getting started, restructuring the application. I've created a whole new project here, and what I'm doing is I'm basically kind of pulling and dragging code in, structuring it a little bit differently, redoing my tests to make sure everything is focused as it should be, and then hopefully I'll pop this out really soon. I've probably got another few weeks to go here. I know the holidays are coming up, so I'm really going to try and get this done as soon as I can. Okay, well, first thing here is the structure of the application. You might be wondering, what does a DDD application look like? And well, here it is, hopefully. This is my attempt at it. I've tried to make things really, really simple and straightforward so that when you look at it, you can look at it with the eyes of a business person and sort of say, oh, okay. So in you're saying right here is where the order processing is handled, and why, yes, that is true. So in essence, a DDD application mainly has four layers to it. And the first layer is a UI layer, and you can imagine what that does. Second one is the application layer that handles the application flow. And so you can imagine those two things going together inside of the MVC web application. The MVC has a web view component, so that is the UI. And then the controllers act to handle the flow of the application. So that is both top layers at once. Now, I might be wrong about that, and if I am, someone please let me know. Next up, you have the domain itself, and the domain it would be where your logic lives. So in this case, for the storefront, sales and order processing handle my domain. I'll talk about why these are split in two in just a second. And finally, we have an infrastructure layer here. Infrastructure is horizontal to the rest of the application. It's something that the rest of the application will use. You could think of it kind of in old terms as system data or system common, or not system, but whatever, application.common, where that kind of turned into a dumping ground. Common is way too common a term, and so you want to look at this as sort of base classes, perhaps some helpers. And here you can see I have lazy list and page list. Implementations of patterning and or things you want to do, like iSession is my unit of work implementation here, and I'm going to need that in all my stuff here just about. So that's how that works. That's what infrastructure is. And again, I want to stress that it's not supposed to be a dumping ground. So you might think as you're building out your application, like, oh yeah, well, customer is going to belong in every single part of it. I need to know it in my MVC app. I'm going to need to know it in sales and order processing. And that's not necessarily true. You don't want to be putting domain logic in infrastructure. It just doesn't work. So if you think I'm wrong, please do let me know. Leave a comment and tell me why. But and I don't see it that way. I think infrastructure has to do a lot more with application stuff. Okay, well, moving right along, what are some of the things that I have changed? Well, let's take a look at these two projects here, order processing and sales. This is something that Dave Larrabee talked about, except he didn't call it order processing. He called it fulfillment. He was talking about the notion of a bounded context. And what he was trying to say is that when you build out a model, you build out a domain, eventually you'll get to a point where the entity you're working with, let's say product, starts to get a little bit big and a little bit bloated for what it's trying to do. So, if you imagine that you're building an e-commerce site for a big company, and let's say you have a warehouse, and you know you have a sales team that sells these things, so the sales team is going to go out and sell products, right? They're going to go out and they're going to sell widget A. Well, when they come back and put the order in, that order is going to get fulfilled. So what we could do, being good domain modelers, is we could model that product according to what we need for the sales team. Sales team's going to need to know certain things like color, and a lot of attributes like perhaps size. They're going to want to have some sales mechanisms like coupons and incentives and so on. So we would model it that way to kind of help the sales team sell. Well, none of that stuff is applicable at all once we hand it to the warehouse guy. He doesn't care about color necessarily. What he cares about is SKUs. He might care about warehouse location, size. Perhaps he's probably going to want to know the dimensions of the package so he can set up shipping. So he probably does not care at all about some of the other things the sales guys care about. So you can start to see that the notion of a product starts to change as you get into these different what they call bounded contexts or scopes. And so to that end, I have kind of created two separate projects here, and I'm going to try and address each concern accordingly. Now again, this is where I'm at a disadvantage because I don't actually have a client to sit with and say, so tell me, you know, in your warehouse, how do you consider these items that sit on a shelf? What do you call them? I don't necessarily have that, but I do have dialogues with my old client that I can go over in my head, so hopefully I'll come up with something applicable for you. So that's thing one. Thing two is some of the patterning that I'm working with here. I'll show you two specifically and how I've implemented sort of a DDD favorite patterns in here. I still have my repositories, as I always have. I'm going to be pushing folders around here. I'm probably not going to have one that's just called blanket repositories. I'm probably going to move this straight into customer. You know, all that's still up in the air, so please forgive me. I don't want to talk about what lives where, at least right now. But essentially, I do have the notion of a product repository. I'm still using iQueryable because I love it. And I'll talk about implementations of that in just a second. Well, let's talk about it right now. So if I head on over to the product repository, you can see here I'm still using Link to SQL. I am now doing a unit of work in here. I am injecting unit of work into the repository. Now, what does that mean? What the heck am I talking about? Well, this is an interesting thing here. The concept of a session is the same thing as Link to SQL's data context. So in here, I have a class called SQL Session, which just is an abstraction through an interface of the data context. So in here, I have some basic methods. I have get all, get table. Probably better, let's head up to infrastructure. Take a look at my iSession first. So I have get all, submit changes, attach, insert, remove. So if you've used the data context in Link to SQL, this will immediately look familiar. So for my SQL repositories, I have a hard implementation of this, which is SQL session. And in here, I am simply using kind of a repository T or a session T pattern where I return data. I'm able to submit changes on the context. I'm able to return, perform inserts and attaches and so on. Now, in terms of hardcore DDD, I do know that you should rely on the repositories for a get. You shouldn't necessarily have to use unit of work for that pattern. This is a concession I had to make for Link to SQL because the data context, it will only allow you to alter an entity if you have first pulled it from that context. You can attach it back, but there's some hoops you have to go through. I don't want to deal with those. So I'm just having the session perform gets as well. I hope that makes sense. If not, please leave a comment. I'll try and add some detail to it. I kind of want to move on here. So to show you how this works, let's head over to the product repository. And you can see for get products, normally what I would have done here, what I did in the past, was I would just instantiate the data context in here and work with it directly. That violates the unit of work pattern. By having an injectable pattern like this, I can actually span repositories and ask the session to submit all changes. And so that'll do it transactionally, which is a really nice loose pattern. It also allows you to work with other unit of work repositories like in Hibernate, Entity Framework, and I think there's another one called Lightspeed. So there's those. But to get information out, I just ask the session to go pull me some products. You can see I'm still doing the projection to my model as I did before. And there you are. It's pretty simple stuff. Another thing I'm able to do now is on saves, I was able to clean up a really nasty method, the one where I'm saving, I save an order down to the database. I don't know if you remember it, but it's the one where I commented out, it's the save items on an order. And it was about 80 lines long, and it was horrific. So in this case, I've cleaned that up a lot, and I'll show you how I've done that. In here, I have a simple save method, and it's two lines, which is awesome. I translate the order. In other words, I translate the incoming model order to Link to SQL's model of it. And I know what a lot of folks are saying, why, oh, why, do you have two sets of classes? It's because I just can't get around it. I link to SQL does not map the way I want it to. I want to have an independent model that is not bound to my implementation. I'm doing this actually for your sake, so you can come in here and really quite easily, if you want to put the storefront on top of your own database, without having to work and mangle everything inside of this application, all you've got to do is fill out a repository, your own repository that maps it back to my model. It's easy stuff. You can use this stuff as a pattern, and then you're done. So anyway, the pattern I'm following here for this is to simply translate the order. And so if you come up here, you can see how this works. I take in the model, and then I check the database. I say, hey, is there an order in the database? If there isn't, I create one. And then I set all this information. Now this is working on the data context. I've pulled it out of my unit of work. I've pulled it out of the data context. Now I'm modifying this information. So once I come down here, if it's new, then I just say insert. If it's not, well, there's nothing else I need to do, because the changes are tracked by the data context, tracked by the unit of work. Then I just hit submit changes. Done, which is quite nice. Hopefully you followed that. If you haven't, I will have this up for you soon. You can go through the code. Another place you can see this, let's take a look at a change I've made in the overall approach here, and then you can see see how I've implemented this in the database. I now have a notion of a customer because my old client did, and it made perfect sense to them. Same thing with a shopping cart, made perfect sense to them. They didn't understand why I would create an order if it did not exist yet. You know, if a client comes in and says, "Hey, I want to buy some things," that's not an order. And so I could hear them fighting with me about that. So I changed this. So now a customer has a cart, and the cart is responsible for adding items, taking items away, and so on. I now have cart items as a table in the database. Not that that matters. And now I have a custom repository that handles all of this. The customer is a prime example of an aggregate route. So if I take a look at this class, you can see a thing hanging off it, a shopping cart. And so when I submit the customer for changes, I submit it to the customer repository. The customer repository is responsible for making persisting changes for that aggregate route. Usually that's a one-to-one correspondence right there. So if I come in here to SQL customer repository, I have the same exact pattern that I was using before. I run a translation. I reconcile the items together. I drop them first. If the model doesn't contain the items in the database, I drop them out of the database. I add them in, and it's pretty easy to follow. I've chunked this all out nicely into different methods here, and it's nice when you start doing this work and you start seeing things shake out in a nice, concise way. So that is kind of where I'm at now. And again, I know that I've got a lot of work yet left to do. I'm kind of just highlighting this quickly for you. Finally, the last thing I want to show you is a really cool pattern that I'm using to handle order states or order status. Now before, what I had on the order was a simple enumeration to tell me what state the order was in. In other words, is it new? Is it verified? Is it charged? Has it been shipped? Whatever. Well, I formalize that, and this is one of the things that DDD likes you to do, is to formalize these so that you have encapsulation, the notion of single responsibility, and so on. So what I did is I used the state pattern here. Now, if you don't know what the state pattern is, quickly Wikipedia it, or hit Wikipedia or hit Google. It's a really cool way of implementing flow or state management of an entity. So in here, I have an abstract base class called OrderState. As you can see, I have a bunch of methods on it that kind of handle transition from one state to the next. And then I have some internal methods here that actually implement that. So for instance, and let's just get to brass tacks here. If I have a new order come in, what are the things I can do? Well, I override now implementation details. So I override can change items and can apply discount. And I say these are true. And then if I tell it to submit, it will go ahead and run the internal submit. So if I come down here, what's the internal submit do? It sets the current state of the order to be a new object, which is submitted, which it corresponds to this here. And then I also fire off a event that I've also added. I've added a bunch of eventing here. So this might not make too much sense to you right now. You might be scratching your head like, why would I ever do that? Well, let's take a look. First off, I should say that you can see this is expressed as a property on my order as current state. So this is expressed as the base class. Now let's go ahead and take a look at my tests here for state management. I come into the order, and you can see I've called them status testing. Kind of should be state. So what I can do is I can make these kinds of tests here. I can say, okay, well, I want a new order. And now I'm going to verify that the current state can change the items. And look at that. It's a property. Can I change items? You're just asking the current state. This encapsulates the logic completely in there. Can I apply a discount? Now, this test comes back true because it's a new order. So if, and this is improperly named here, if I do a new order, just created out of the blue, can I refund? And you just ask, order current state dot refund. It'll, boom, it'll throw. And the reason why it throws is because it's not implemented, and, excuse me, not that it's not implemented, it's not allowed, because you can't refund a new order. It doesn't make sense. So you can start to see how the state pattern is starting to handle this stuff. And say, ship, it'll throw, it'll stop everything, because you can't ship a new order. You need certain things to happen. So to kind of show you this down here, I have one big massive method test to kind of test everything end to end. And so you can see here that I'm making sure that all this stuff fails as it should, and then I transition. So I can transition from new order, I can transition to verify, or excuse me, I can transmit, go to submit. This is my first step. I can go to submit. Sure, that won't throw because a new order, the next step is submit. And what that does is it sets the current state to submitted. Do a couple more tests here, make sure things fail. And the next thing I can do is go to verify. Then I can go to charge, and then I can go to return. So all of this is handled by you explicitly in code. This is a nice way to implement this logic, which is actually quite detailed. Now, if you're wondering, really, Rob, is it that big of a deal? Well, think about how you'd handle this in the future. You know, I had in one of my order service methods, I had a method called refund, where it actually would refund the order. I had to go in there and I had to check that the order was in refundable status. Oh man, that was a lot of logic, and it was buried inside of that method, inside of the order service class. That was validation business rule logic buried inside of that class. That was bad. It was hard to find. That was a big fat code smell. Now instead, you have this explicitly declared as objects inside that adhere to your order. Whew. Okay, a lot of talk there. There's a lot more coming. I'm going to try and document this as I go along. As I mentioned, I have a nice interview with Allende, and I've got a nice code review coming up with Scott Belware, where we're going to talk about how I've implemented things and how it can be better. Thank you so much for watching. This is the end of 25. ¶¶